Let's welcome our political commentators now, and today it is Fletcher Tabateau and Gareth Hughes. Kia ora korua, welcome.
Kia ora morena.
Thanks for your time. Fletcher Tabateau is a former New Zealand First MP from 2014 to 2020, former Deputy Leader of the Party, former Parliamentary Under-Secretary to the then Minister of Foreign Affairs, Winston Peters, who is again, and the then Minister of Regional Development, Shane Jones. He now works for lobbying and communications firm, Capital Government Relations. Gareth Hughes is a former Green MP and now works for the Wellington Economy Alliance, Aotearoa, no longer a member of any political party.
I should clarify the Wellbeing Economy Alliance.
What did I call you?
Wellington Economy.
Oh, goodness. Well, that's on a lot of people's minds at the moment with respect to the public service, but Wellington Wellbeing Economy Alliance, Aotearoa, it is. Okay, that budget. I was just mentioning this morning that the pre-budget announcements will be ramping up over the next month or so. Today it was announced that Pharmac's budget will get a $1.7 billion boost over the next 4 years. It's made by the Associate Health Minister, David Seymour. That'll bring its total budget up to $6.3 billion, and these announcements will keep rolling out, but this is probably around about the time that final sign-off is required for next month's budget. And there's been speculation over the weeks, Fletcher, that things have been pretty testy with the three coalition parties all trying to squeeze into the budget restrictions. What's your understanding of how negotiations have gone?
I thought the announcement this morning on Pharmac was a good one to try and understand the measure of the agreement. For example, only New Zealand First had an increase in Pharmac funding in their coalition agreement. So, you know, you could read that and say, well, they're meeting and there's an agreement of the minds there. But then on the other side of the same coin, you could easily argue, well, actually, it's essentially just an increase in operational funding that kind of keep them in the same place, as it were, like no new drugs. So it'll be interesting to see, as an example, what that Pharmac funding looks like come budget day, as an example. Generally, I think you're right. I've certainly heard, I mean, almost since the parties came into office, there's been a lot of contentious meetings about allocation of funding, probably even within the National Caucus itself. You know, it's not just the coalition parties. I think you've got a lot of earnest ministers wanting to do their best through their portfolios and their ministries. And the reality is you've got a Minister of Finance who is kind of trying to deal with some really hard realities around, you know, Crown expenses are up 84% in the last kind of 5 years, and their core Crown revenue is only up 66%. So, you know, there's some reality checks to be had, and I think it's being tough on everyone in government.
Mr. Peters, in his State of the Nation speech, which ended up, of course, being reported for other reasons at the time, that was where, around that time, that he also confirmed what he perceived as being the size of the budget gap, if you like, the budget shortfall, and also there was some veiled criticism of where National ministers are at in their proposals, the affordability of tax cuts and so forth. Now, is that or has that led to any other likely compromises necessarily over National's tax package in particular? Or was that just exercising some muscle while the opportunity was there?
My sense is that the tax cuts are a given and they will happen. And I think there's some political realities to be seen there. Like, I believe even the National Party support base are only 50-50 on the necessity of those tax cuts. I think ACT's not too far away, and every other political party say they're not necessary. But I think where I took heart, and I think you might see it's an indication of a change in language, at least from the Finance Minister, Nicola Willis, is that she's willing to have conversations around government borrowing and government debt. So she's acknowledged in an article this morning that there will be spending that will need to take on debt, but it has to be what I would coin smart spending, like it's going to add long-term value, for example, around health, around infrastructure, climate adaptation, that there is conversations to be had around debt. And I think that's a slight change in her own language. And I that definitely gives me a great deal of hope as to the balancing out of the budget. I think there's some political realities to consider as well.
It was interesting, Gareth, to see that talk about inflation being the number one bogey just in the finance minister's comments. And we've spoken previously about whether she's got to deliver those tax cuts. They've already kicked off pretty much for the in terms of the landlords. But whether there is the possibility of delaying some of this, phasing some of this. And do you view that as a bit of positioning on that front?
Well, I think it's pretty inevitable that there's going to be either a reduction in the overall package. You know, it's pretty clear that they're not going to be able to deliver what National campaigned so assiduously over the election. It's going to be either a less of a tax cut or more likely a staged tax cut. And this is what I imagine New Zealand First, you know, as a sort of a leading opponent of the tax cuts, would be proposing. Because I guess, you know, the government's in a tough place. They promised a fiscally neutral tax cut package. A whole bunch of the revenue side was reduced through the coalition negotiations. Then economic conditions, that government revenue's down. It's a really tough position to be. So they've only got a few choices. Borrow more, as Fletcher indicated. And, you know, noting New Zealand's crown debt is in the, you know, bottom half of the OECD, there is definitely room to move there. Make cuts, which, you know, they have made cuts, and every week there's a new headline around, be it, you know, the digital, you know, harmful behaviour with children unit being cut, or the urgent, you know, $105 million in hospitals being cut.
Customs.
Yeah, every week, you know, every day almost there's a new one. Or push the burden onto others. And that's what we've also seen. So a mix of borrowing, a mix of spending cuts, but also pushing it onto others, be it councils, be it motorists with the road user charges, be it, you know, households when it comes to things like the climate liability.
So you've just touched on something, which is what is frontline and what's not. And we have seen some, I mean, that internal affairs group that does world-leading work, for example, in online child abuse. I'm not saying that unit is specifically affected. But internal affairs has got some interesting operations that often don't get a lot of headlines, but do some pretty important work. You wonder sometimes whether these types of proposals are the ones that make the headlines for a reason. But nonetheless, if they're being proposed, or if people who train customs dogs are being proposed, it is a bad headline for the government.
Oh, absolutely. And it's easy to say they're going to go through line by line during an election campaign, but the rubber's hitting the road and the chickens are coming home to roost. And we're talking about, you know, tangible cuts that people can see. We're talking about, you know, people in different communities, customs officers are going to disappear from Whangarei, Gisborne, Timaru, etc. You know, people can actually visualise it and see it happening in their community. And for some, you know, on a hospital waiting list at the moment, seeing what's happening in the hospitals and the urgent funding cuts that are needed and been announced, you know, it's going to be pretty cold medicine for them.
Let's talk about the return of the three strikes law again. This is part of the coalition agreement. Many people saying there is absolutely no evidence that this is effective, and others also saying, I know certainly the legal fraternity were outraged by it with respect to how it could capture people with various disabilities. There was a particularly high-profile case. It has been modified somewhat, Fletcher, but is this a case again of the government ticking off the agreements in that coalition deal, come hell or high water?
Yes, basically that's the answer. It's you've got three parties who believed in principle in the three strikes, and they've brought it back, and they have modified it. And I think 27 people in New Zealand have been prosecuted under it in the last few years. So the threshold's quite high, but you know there is some political sympathy for the idea that, you know, the worst of the worst need to be kept away from the rest of the public. You know, sometimes it's not about rehabilitation. Sometimes it's not, you know, the criminal being looked after. It's the reality of sometimes we just need to take people out of society and make sure it's harder for them to come back in.
Gareth, is there more flexibility in this latest iteration for discretion and we know of the high profile case, the one that went all the way through the courts, with respect to someone who clearly had mental health issues and whose offence, I think, was kissing someone in Cuba Mall. Please don't. I don't want to minimise that, but this is an example of where discretion is needed. Is it built in this time?
Well, I think they're attempting to do it because there's been that high-profile example. Labour, in their opposition to it, highlighted the case where someone patted a prison officer in a prison, got 7 years jail for that single offence because they were on their third strike. And, you know, there's really egregious examples like that that people can point to. So what the government has done is there's 40 serious violent and sexual offences in the former legislation. Now they're applying it only to offences over 24 months. So that third strike, if it's a pretty minor offence, won't be the, you know, long-term jail, 7-10 years that some people have been facing. But again, you know, you can put this policy in the basket with gang patches and boot camps. It's not an evidence-based policy. I googled, looked at the Ministry of Justice website this morning. The first sentence on their explainer of the policy was, quote, "There is no substantial international or New Zealand evidence on the effects of three strikes legislation." This is politics through and through.
Politics. Can't take the politics out of politics. Politics certainly is ramping up, and so is the scrutiny of the government's environmental law changes, and specifically the fast-tracking legislation. An Auditor General who's never been short of a word or a criticism, particularly of the previous government, and a Parliamentary Environment Commissioner who was a very senior figure in the previous National Government, both really laying into this law. Fletcher, what is your take? This can have two impacts. It can see the law amended and, if select committees work properly, amended to be better. But will it by any means undermine the fundamental tenet of the law that in the end three ministers end up with final say over projects going ahead or not?
I don't think it undermines the tenet of the law. I don't think the argument about undermining democracy is...
I've not made myself clear. Will any changes undermine the fundamental of the proposed law, which is that three ministers ultimately will have final say, and one of them is not the Environment Minister?
Look, to be honest, I haven't seen anything to indicate that anything coming out there will change the construct of the proposed format of the fast-track consenting process. I think we're still seeing three ministers at the head of the decision-making process. There will be a whole lot of work behind the scenes that actually brings it up for their consideration, and then they have their independent advisory group. So, yes, to your point, it'd be interesting to see if there are any changes, but I haven't seen anything to indicate that at this stage.
Well, we did see the Minister, Chris Bishop, say he was open to pragmatic solutions, and we're seeing some heavy hitters come out in opposition to the substance of the legislation. You know, I, like many people, put a submission in as well, and I think there'll be thousands, no doubt, that the Select Committee will have to go through. But we also see opposition to the process, and Bishop was quite quick to say he wasn't forced by the Ombudsman, but clearly in conversations after a complaint to the Ombudsman office that the list of invitees to the fast track process hadn't been disclosed, and that only came the afternoon that submissions were due. So it's clear that it was a pretty poor process as well. And look, there are always going to be, I think it's absolutely inappropriate that we're sending invitations to entities that are donors to the political parties involved in drafting the legislation and will be the ministers, breaching the sort of democratic norms, as you pointed out, Catherine, on how resource processes proceed.
And this is a political risk for the government. The question is how much it cares, Fletcher. And again, your interest is fairly obvious, having worked for the then Regional Development Minister, Shane Jones, who is one of the three ministers that we're talking about here, the Transport Minister, Simeon Brown, and Chris Bishop as Infrastructure, RMA Reform, and goodness knows how many others are the three ministers we're talking about. There is a perception, at the very least, of conflict of interest and will be on any number of occasions, and onto it, opposition will be highlighting this every opportunity it gets. The question is whether this government cares about that or whether this government will potentially be harmed by it, Fletcher.
So absolutely, there will be perceptions of conflict of interest, and those have to be managed, very assiduously. I think it could potentially be a political problem. My view on that is those on the first phase of the fast-tracking process, those companies will be, putting themselves on a list for public scrutiny, and they need to be aware of that. But, it's a political ideology where I know, for example, Shane Jones has made the decision. The cabinet manual has made it clear on how to manage these conflicts. They will be managed. And he just wants to get out and engage and meet everyone and make things happen, get investments happening back in New Zealand. I think they need to be concerned and make sure it's highly transparent. But yes, I think the political appetite is to get things done.
Which is kind of ironic because Transparency International last week came out and slammed the legislation for its lack of transparency and ability to deal with those conflicts of interest. We're talking about billions of dollars of investment, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars of donations to political parties. And Minister Jones's comments, don't give me a huge amount of confidence, the way he talks about frogs and kiwis and a cancel economy. I think the government's going to try and plough through and weather it. They're still in an early period. And, I saw the Ipsos poll that came out last week, which quite incredibly, much more than many other similar countries, 54% of New Zealanders want a strong leader who's even willing to break the law. And I think that sort of sense of zeitgeist that Shane Jones and others is trying to tap into. But it's going to be in a few years when these projects are happening in communities' backyards or affecting landowners and they didn't have the ability to submit because it was non-notified. That's when we're going to see the political problems emerge, and inevitably this legislation will be repealed.
All right. The question is whether that backlash comes sooner. And I can't remember who was writing the weekend. It might have been Vernon Small referencing the Manapouri going all the way back, the Manapouri project. The question is whether you rack up a community or communities enough in the time frame for it to have a nearer term impact. However, to Fletcher's point, there has been so much frustration with the failure to get any number of projects up and running that perhaps there is a public tolerance for it right now.
Oh, absolutely. And remember, this isn't going to benefit your mum and dad wanting to build a house or a medium-scale development, in a suburb. This is about these, mega projects and, these 200, privileged entities that got an invitation. We're talking about seabed mining and other, massive projects. We're not resolving the issues when it comes to the majority of economic activity in this country. It's these privileged large entities.
All right. Let's finish with James Shaw. He's got his valedictory speech coming up on Wednesday, I think it is. And he gave an interesting interview to Q&A at the weekend, Fletcher, where he just came out and said, well, first, there have been times when he thought about quitting. I'm not sure if anyone's gone through Parliament without those, Gareth? or Fletcher? But equally, he was quite pro the concept that the Greens, to be in a more kind of powerful political position, need to talk across the aisle, need to be part of talking to National about forming governments in the future. This has been such a hot potato within the party for a long time, and we'll come to Gareth's comments in a moment. But what is your view on the plausibility of that, especially in the current iteration of the Greens?
Sorry, are you asking
yes,
me?
Yes, I'm asking you in the first instance.
Yeah. So, look, first of all, it's an opportunity for me to acknowledge James Shaw, who's been a friend of mine for 9 years now. We both started at the same time and traversed politics together, and just acknowledge the great work he's done. But to your question around the Greens, I think that's what he did. It'd be interesting to hear Gareth's insight, though. My perception is that James was able to convince the party to actually have those pragmatic conversations around, what's the phrase around kind of perfect is the enemy and good is good enough?
Yeah, perfect's the enemy of the good.
We're not going to win all of the battles. So let's have the conversations that we can have, and let's progress towards and on the pathway that we best see for the country. And I think that James was able to achieve that and managed to pull in his caucus into the same thinking, and in that way I genuinely believed he achieved a lot for the Green Party.
How viable is it, as I said, particularly in this current iteration of the Greens in Parliament, let alone the membership, for this to come seriously as a proposition?
It depends. When you're talking about working on policies together, you know, clearly James did that with the Zero Carbon Act.
The question was specifically about being prepared to talk about government negotiations.
Oh, no, that's right. And, you know, here, I thought quite an excellent interview with Jack Tame in Q&A. He, you know, was quite explicit that he would have been willing to pick up the phone had Christopher Luxon worked with him post the current election to lock out New Zealand First and ACT, because those numbers were there. I mean, a bit cute by half that he said that I wouldn't have called Christopher Luxon, but had he called me, I would have tried. And then tried to, you know, he made the case that it hasn't been tested in the party, which is true, and he thought it might actually be possible.
Has it never been tested in the party because no one ever thought it would fly?
I think that's very true. I mean, there was, I think James did float this in 2017 as well, when there was, you know, was unclear if New Zealand First was going to go with National or with Labour. There was, you know, a strong distaste within the party back then. And former iterations of the caucuses used to say it would never, ever be possible. But remember, working across party lines, not to form a government, but to advance policies, goes back an awful long time.
Yeah, that's a different thing. That is a different thing, however. And remember, this is a party that's only just Finally, did it yet have a minister in cabinet last time? It's had ministers outside of cabinet.
Well, we're seeing now with Melissa Lee and Penny Simmons demotions that we're seeing for the first time ever a climate change minister inside the cabinet.
Okay. Your summing up of Shaw's place then in the party's history. Because, you know, we've had the activist base sometimes say he's far too to the centre. We had the activist base make him reapply for his job. Your take on his legacy?
Oh, I mean, quite a phenomenal politician, you know. And I think that interview demonstrated some of his skills, you know, unflappable, calm, appearing very reasonable, able to interject humour into the conversation. You know, so quite a personable, affable politician. I think, however, for members, they would have liked to have known earlier how hard he was fighting behind the scenes and went as far as drafting a letter. He held his cards quite close to his chest, and there was that split within the party that didn't see him advocating strongly enough for green principles and maybe trying to sell defeats as wins. But, you know, clearly a politician who's had a huge impact on the party. The Zero Carbon Act is a huge testament to sort of almost an older fashioned politics where parties could work across the lines. And it was interesting how he noted in an interview that much of his work has actually been scrapped by the incoming government, and we have a much more partisan politics, which I think is quite accurate.
Thank you, Gareth Hughes. Thank you, Fletcher Tabatot.